Readers Entertainment presents Book Lights, where we are shining the light on good books.
Happy Tuesday, everyone. I hope that it is warming up where you are. It's been kind of rainy here in San Diego, but I am very excited that today we have on New York Times bestselling author Christopher Rice, who is a fabulous guy. So if you ever get the chance to go to an event where Christopher Rice is signing, go. You will have so much fun, I promise you. Anyway, if you haven't met Christopher yet, let me read his short little bio, and then you'll get to chat with him. So by the age of 30, Christopher Rice had published 4 New York Times bestselling thrillers, received a Lambda Literary Award, and declared one of People magazine's sexiest men alive. Oh, my gosh, I remember that. His 2 novels of dark supernatural suspense, The Heavens Rise and The Vines, were both finalists for a Bram Stoker Award. He recently entered the erotic romance genre with 3 works in an all-new series called The Desire Exchange. I read the first book in that. Oh, my gosh, you guys, you need to read it. They include The Flame, The Surrender Gate, and Kiss the Flame. His debut novel, A Density of Souls, was published when he was only 22 years old, a controversial and overnight bestseller. It was greeted with a landslide of media attention, much of it devoted to the fact that Christopher, yes, he is the son of the famed vampire Chronicle Anne Rice. So, in case you were wondering, you can learn more at his website. I did put the link to his website on our blog talk page. And also, he's very active on Twitter. It's so worth following. He will make you smile every day. And also on Facebook as well. So, Christopher, are you there?
I'm here. I'm one of the few people on Twitter who's making people smile lately. It seems like there are not a lot of smiles to go around on Twitter these
days,
so I'm happy to have this plug. Thank you, Lisa.
Yes, Twitter has been a lot of hand-wringing lately.
Yeah.
So you have a brand new book out, Bone Music, and if you haven't heard about it out there, what can you tell readers? Why should they go get it today?
Well, you know, they should go get it today only if they have always wanted to see a really powerful woman kick the crap out of some really horrible serial killers. That's the elevator pitch.
Woo-hoo!
That's actually shorter than the elevator pitch. You know, Bone Music is it's romantic suspense, it's a page-turning thriller, it's a revenge story, it's a vigilante story, and it's a strong woman story. And those are all things that I'm really excited about right now, and I think that they're – seem to be things other people are excited about because the book is doing really well. It was part of Amazon First Reads last month, which is one of their great sort of promotional pushes. They give some new titles, and it's the enthusiasm has carried over into its first month of sales, so I'm really excited about that. And you know, I wrote Bone Music because I was so traumatized. This was about 8 or 10 years ago. By a friend's description of a scene from a horror movie that was not released yet. He'd read about it in a magazine. And it was a scene of a woman being tortured. And I was so upset by it that the only way to really get it out of my head, or to purge myself of its darker aspects, if you will, was to begin writing a scenario in which a woman could get free from this horrible killer. And so that was the seed of the idea. And it took the seed a long time to really grow. You get idea. I'm sure you've gone through this too, Lisa, where you get an idea and it's just not the idea's time yet, but it sort of sticks around.
Exactly.
People call them plot bunnies, you know?
Right.
So yeah.
Right.
So
you jot those down when they come to you?
You know what usually happens is I make a run at them in a notebook. And the run usually doesn't go very far. So yeah, technically I'm jotting them down, but I really sit down with a pen and paper thinking I can try to get to the heart of an outline or a synopsis, and I'll keep running up against a wall. And the wall I kept running up against this was, where did this woman's power come from? And in my head, just in a sort of visualizing this scene, this turning the tables on a torture murderer scene, she kept being an alien. I was like, and then where did it go? Like, how did she have alien powers? Were they abducted by aliens together? Were they on an alien spaceship? I mean, it was just, and the idea would just die again and again and again. And so I sat down for lunch with a friend of mine who worked at Amazon at the time, who had I worked on marketing for some books I'd done with them, and my best friend, Eric Sharquin, who's also a very talented writer, who I did the Dinner Party Show with. And you can see all our podcasts and videos at thedinnerpartyshow.com, plug.
And you should. They're very funny.
Thank you very much. We have a lot
of
fun doing
that. And your mom
is
a guest on there a couple times.
Yes,
too.
She is.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So, Anne Rice fans out there, go check out the Dinner Party Show.
Absolutely. So I sat down for a lunch, and Eric and I were in Seattle. They were testing out a musical version of a novel my mother wrote many years ago called Cry to Heaven, which is still in development, and fingers crossed it's going to eventually make its way to Broadway. But this was Yeah, it was really, it's gorgeous music. It's by Matthew Wilder, who did Mulan and who wrote that famous pop song, No One's Gonna Bring Me Down. I think that's the name of it.
Didn't he do Jekyll and Hyde too? No, maybe
I don't know if he did Jekyll and Hyde. I actually think Jekyll and Hyde might have been somebody different. But anyway, it's beautiful music, and we were there to hear them sing the songs. And so we just, on the off chance, we said, let's have lunch with our friend Jackie. And I started talking to her about, you know, what was really working at Amazon Publishing, what books were really popular. And she said, it's a time for strong women and vigilantes. You know, those are the books that are doing well for us. And I said, well, it just so happens I have this idea. And I sort of laid it out for them, and I said, but there are aliens in it. And they both looked at me and said, get rid of the aliens. Like, this isn't hard. Get rid of the aliens. And, you know, it was a humorous conversation, because aliens, unless you are committed to writing an alien universe or an alien series, as a sort of easy plot explanation, they're like death. They're plot death, because it's just sort of like, if you don't have anything interesting or new to say, if you don't have an alien world to render, it came from outer space. It's like the worst explanation you can come up with. So I walked away from the conversation realizing that what they were saying to me was that my main character was strong enough that she didn't need this other super tropey plot, pop culture, not cliche, but, you know, sort of like element in the book. Like, her story, if I leaned into her story, was going to be. And that was really how it was born. You know, I think that sometimes happens. Some people they're very guarded. They don't want to talk about work. They don't want to talk about their work. They want to live in their head with it before they share it with anyone. But I sometimes find myself liberated by those early conversations.
Right. Sometimes there's something about people will throw out ideas and they're always wrong, but it will spark something that's right for you. Yeah.
Yes. I like to call it the third thing. I think it comes out of a lot of different notes, processes. Yeah, I've experienced it in Hollywood, too. I think it comes out of publishing editorial letters, is that it's not the thing you've done initially, and it's not the thing they want, but you come up with the third thing. And I think that can be, when collaboration is going well or when editorial is going well, that's what it produces again and again.
I agree. So, are there aliens in it?
No, there are no aliens. What immediately happened in the conversation was it was like, why isn't it a drug? Why can't it just be some sort of drug that somebody has developed, which gives her this burst of super strength that she can use to get free of this horrible killer's trap, and the killer doesn't know she's on it, so it's really the killer who has walked into a trap. And that became the core of the book. And then the story of who developed the drug and how the drug got out into the world, and did anybody else have it or just her? All of that became the book. And, you know, it became what I like to call, I didn't invent the term, but I'm very comfortable with the term, a sci-fi crossover novel, which means there's one element that's kind of supernatural, paranormal, or extraordinary, but it is grounded in what is otherwise a pretty relatable and believable down here on Earth world. And that was how the book took shape, right? There was an actual pharmaceutical company that had worked to develop a drug that turned into this drug unexpectedly, causing chaos at the company. A scientist went rogue with it. He tracked down this woman for reasons that will be revealed to those who read the book, and slipped her the drug. And she begins this journey with it, and you know, that's really the book, but it's also the beginning of what I hope will be a very long series of novels.
Oh, nice. That was going to be my next question. Is it going to be a series or is it just a standalone?
Yes. It will be
Yay.
A series. The sequel will be out. I'm working on it now, and it will be out probably a year from now. It's called Blood Echo, and it's already available for pre-order.
Wow, you go, Amazon.
Right?
They're on it.
They are.
So will it have the same heroine for every book? I know some thrillers have the same detectives and that kind of thing. Is it the same heroine or different?
For the time being, yes, it will. For the time being, it's called the Burning Girl series, and there is a character whose nickname is Burning Girl for reasons that will be revealed. And well, they are revealed in the first book, but I won't go into them now because it would take me all day. But she is Charlotte Rowe. That's the alias she has adopted in her adult life to distance herself from a painful past. And she's the focus of the book. But I think people will see the world of the book is pretty large and it can expand in a lot of different directions if the series really grows legs.
Right. And if there's a drug on the loose, they could always juice up somebody else too. And
yes, but there's a catch. There's a catch. For some reason, the drug only works in her.
No.
And they're trying to figure out why. Yeah. Because
they
tested the drug on other people and it went terribly wrong. But So that's all I'm going to say. You got to read the book if you want to know anything else. But yeah, so there's a lot that it really is about one woman's journey through these extraordinary circumstances after she's given this incredible power and how she chooses to use it.
Okay. Well, I am super intrigued. I'm going to go get it. I hope everyone listening will go get it because then we get more books, right?
Absolutely.
For the readers out there who are listening, I'm also a writer, and I know painfully so many writer friends who have these great ideas for series, and there are so many readers out there who say, I'm going to wait till the whole series comes out, and then I'm going to buy the whole thing. But when you do that, it makes it so that publishers won't finish the series because the sales aren't there, and then the poor authors were sitting over there going, no, I had 5 more books, and we don't get to write them. So...
That's very true. I'm sorry to say that is very true. And I think since I've taken a book by book approach to things because I've had to financially, and there's things that I had hoped would grow into series that I wasn't able to continue because the sales just weren't there or the publisher wasn't confident enough. And
right.
You know, it's a bummer. So it is like we're in this sort of voting system now. You've got to vote with a purchase for what you want to see more of.
Exactly. Yeah. And it happens to so many great books. My husband used to love this sci-fi series and 4 books came out and then no more. And the internet was just beginning back then. And he did a Google search on the author and he was a professor at a university with an email. So he emailed him and told him how much he loved the series and when's the next book going to come out. And he got an email back. I had to go back to teaching because the sales wasn't there. So there won't be another book. And he was like, no.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, it happens and it's been happening forever. So yeah, vote with your dollars and go grab the book so there can be more.
Yes, exactly.
Now, for you, you've done erotic romance thrillers and recently mummies. Is there a genre you haven't written yet that you want to write?
Well, you know, I used to say comedy before I remembered that the Dinner Party Show is a lot of comedy. It's just performed. A lot of what we did was podcast and radio as well as a few YouTube videos. But I've never really written a comic novel from start to finish. And, my friend Eric Jarquin, he makes fun of me because I once presented him with – I said, I'm going to write a comedy. And Eric said, let me guess, it's a comedy in which dark forces kill hundreds of people. And I was like, actually, yeah, it kind of is. And he was like, that's not
totally
a comedy,
is.
Christopher. You know, so I was always worried that my comic ideas were too dark. But I think that at the present time, you know, I've done horror. I've now done something historical with Mom, with our collaboration with Ramses the Dam, the sequel. I've done erotic romance. I've done what I never said I would do, which is I've written books that have absolutely no gay characters in them. You know, Dance of Desire had no gay characters in it. It was a romance novella I wrote for 1001 Dark Nights. I've done a lot of things that I said I would never do. So I certainly wouldn't rule anything out. I think probably what would what could be challenging for me is a really long book-length work of nonfiction. I'm not a memoir fan. I don't read them.
Mm-hmm.
I was set back by the revelation over the past few decades that a lot of really popular memoirs were fake, you know, manufactured.
Right. Ghostwritten, yeah.
Yeah, ghostwritten or just, you know, made up in the case of James Frey in A Million Little Pieces.
Right.
There's something about memoir culture that I'm really a fiction person, and I think there are great truths that we reveal even about ourselves through fiction and myth and folklore and those things that sort of keep us spiritually engaged with the world. I think if you want somebody, you want to hear somebody lie, ask them to tell the truth about themselves. I just know I always lied every time when I was a smoker and people asked mm-hmm. me how much I smoked. I always rounded up or rounded down. So maybe I'm projecting onto other people. I think if you ask them about their lives, they're going to round up or they're going to round down. You know, like...
Yeah.
So,
well, I have this weird inner editor who is fine with fiction, but if I start writing nonfiction, even when I'm teaching, you know, an online class or something and I'm writing out the materials, I have this editor inside who's going, who cares? This is boring.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why would anyone care? So I can't even, I just cringe thinking about if I was ever to write a memoir because that voice would constantly be going, who cares? Why does
yeah.
it matter?
Well, and it's a valid question. I think we think it every time we sit down to write a book, unless we're just doing something that we don't care about how it sells or how it's received. The question of who cares about this is a totally valid one. And I think what I see is that in order to make people care, memoirists start embellishing and making things up. And they essentially become – the term that I've never been able to really contend with is creative nonfiction. What
yeah,
is that?
Yeah, I don't like that
like
either.
You're either
yeah.
it's either fiction or it isn't.
Well,
I
and
just,
they have this new category of fictional memoir. I'm like, wouldn't that just be fiction?
Yeah, it
not
is.
Not really a memoir.
I'm going to answer the question for you. It is. It's fiction. So I think that would be, you know, it's always possible to focus in on one pivotal event from your life if you think you have something to say about it and you think it's interesting
right.
and you have something to relate that's bigger than just these are my feelings here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, maybe. But I definitely think, like, I would love to rise to the challenge of writing a work of true crime, you know, something that involved investigative journalism.
Oh,
or,
I would love
you
that,
know.
Too.
Yeah.
Did you read
but,
all
you know,
the
John
Anne Rule
Grisham
books?
Said it was very hard. He said he would never do it again. He wrote about an old crime, and he said he couldn't get people to talk to him. He said he understood what reporters went through when a source just won't give up any information,
oh. mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I went through a period, I read all the Anne Rule books. Oh, my gosh, I was so intrigued. But it does seem like it would be an incredible amount of work.
Yeah.
Pretty
yeah,
soon I'd be
is.
Making it up.
Yeah, that's the danger, too. That's the danger, too. You know, like I think the Jason Blair effect, right? You don't want to leave your desk
mm-hmm.
so you start making up that you went places you never went. But anyway.
Right. Well, you did write about a mummy, and... So, and you co-wrote that one with your mom, right?
I did, absolutely. We did. She had been asked for years and years and years to do a sequel to The Mummy, and she never felt like it was the right time. And she finally turned to me and said, would you like to do this with me? And I was initially hesitant because I had never written anything historical before,
mm-hmm.
unless you counted a few flashbacks to the 60s and some older books of mine, which weren't really... which were just about the characters. They weren't about the political scene or anything like that. So
right.
I said I would do it, and we sat down and hammered out the beats of the plot on some notepads around the table at her house, and she really gave me broad license to take those beats and go off and really write a draft that – explored things and tried stuff out and tested things that maybe weren't going to work. And then we sat down together with that draft and pulled it apart and talked about what was working and what wasn't and what was true to the original book and what wasn't. And I went off and wrote another draft, and then she wrote the final pass. So we didn't do what a lot of my romance friends do, which is writing in a Google Doc side by side, you know, simultaneously,
right.
even if they're on other sides of the world. There was no way to do that. I mean, there was no way we could do that. So,
right.
But the way we did it allowed for a lot of room and a lot of space that
mm-hmm.
made the collaboration easier and time to process what the other had done and really go through it. The challenge was that the original book ends on a cliffhanger. And
right.
we were determined to pick up right from where the cliffhanger left off. So
right.
That meant we needed to catch people up. It had been something like, I think, 30 years since the first book had
right.
come out.
That's a long cliffhanger.
Right. We needed a refresher. We had a little intro. And we wrote it in such a way that ideally you could pick it up and be completely caught up about what was happening. And we introduced – the place where we could really work closely together was in building and introducing new characters, because there's a sort of new cast that comes in to join the previous cast. And that was really exciting and fun. And I think the character
we were
the most –
And Cleopatra's in there, right?
Oh, yeah. Cleopatra's in there. And that was, you know, really the most interesting thing about the collaboration for me. What I learned is that I was really dogged in my insistence at the outset that Cleopatra be our villain. I felt that she had been set up that way in the first book,
mm-hmm.
and I felt the book to maintain that sort of adventurous H. Rider Haggard galloping feel, we needed a monster. And when I got into the thick of it in that first draft, and Mom conceded, she said, okay, give it a try, do what you think is best, I realized right away that I was very wrong, that she was way too complex and interesting a character. I mean, she had committed murders in the first book, but she had been resurrected without her consent and in a state of almost mad confusion, unsure of what era she was in, endowed with super strength by the elixir of life. I mean, these were things like that she was going to have to work through, but she was more than just a cardboard villain. And
right.
the book came to focus on her journey, and I think that's why we called it The Passion of Cleopatra. It was sort of a take on the passion of the Christ, which I don't think a lot of people get, because I think they think it's all about passion and eroticism and romance, which is fine, but it's really
right.
about her struggling along the stations of her own cross to sort of figure out who she is, because what we introduce is this idea that pops up a little in the first book that if you are brought back to life after death by the elixir of life, you may not really be you. You may be a clone. You may be an almost like a zombie version of you. The real you might have gone on with your soul and been reborn.
Mm.
And so that's the idea that we decided to play with in the sequel, and that's how she became the center of it.
Nice. When you agreed to do this, had you already read The First Mummy? How old were you when you read that?
Oh, I had read it. I think I might have even read it more than once. You know, because we had talked about the possibility of my adapting it for film or television.
I see.
Yeah, we had played around with the book before, and I had absolutely read it. And what I was so taken with about it is that it is markedly different in structure and tone from a lot of her other books. And
mm-hmm.
it seemed, as the result of that, to have its own fan base, you know, a sort of fan base within the vampire fan base that was particularly devoted to it, because it had some things that were structurally and tonally different, and it had this lush Edwardian, you know, Downton Abbey almost atmosphere colliding with these elements that were almost Game of Thrones-like, you know, and that's how I would pitch it to people. It was a Downton Abbey meets Game of Thrones, you know. So, I was very familiar with the book, and I also knew it would be a challenge for that reason, because it was pretty outside of my wheelhouse.
And how challenging was it to work with your mom? I mean, because you've got the mom-kid dynamic too.
Well, that's always challenging, and you know that's I always have to make a commitment to interacting like a business professional and not a son who's not getting his way in a certain situation,
right.
and that's not. That's not always easy, and my record is not spotless in that regard. But I will say that we right, like, come on, because I said.
Come on. It's my favorite part.
But also, you know, working, I'll tell you, this is what made the collaboration easier, is that it was her world. We were not building the world together. It was pre-built. So it was
right.
almost like being hired, not as a staff writer necessarily, but it was being hired to create something where the four walls had already been built, and you were working
right.
within those four walls.
Right. Like you're in one of the Nancy Drew, you know, they give you the giant
yeah.
Bible and off you go.
Exactly. Exactly. Totally.
Nice. So you guys didn't get in any family fights because you didn't like the edits?
No, not over that book. Not over that
book.
I mean,
good.
we've had disagreements over other things, but that book, I think we were spared. I remember getting the note towards the end, not enough hats. It's the Edwardian period. Everybody needs more hats. And so she went in and she added more hats. She said, you know. And that was fine with me because she had a really deep grasp of the period that I didn't necessarily had. I'd researched, but she had already lived
right.
in it once and loved it.
More hats.
More hats. Needs more cowbell.
Exactly. Yeah, I've never
right.
heard that edit before. Need more hats.
Right, exactly.
Oh, my gosh. Now, this is going to be the best segue. Speaking of hats, you are also wearing a hat. Isn't that great? I'm really proud of myself. You are working on adapting the Vampire Chronicles for TV.
I am.
And everyone's super excited.
And we're super excited about it. And the great, it's not a tragedy, but it's the most exciting and at times quick-moving thing happening in my life, and I am not allowed to discuss any of it at the present time, which I was apologizing to you before
we went
on the air.
We're not going to get any secrets.
I can't really – you know, what I can say is what I've been saying right along, which is that the promise that Mom made her readers, that this would be a long-form serial narrative focusing on the life of Lestat, starting with his boyhood in France and moving very quickly into his being turned into a vampire – we are still – everyone involved is absolutely committed to making that show. And so we are on track to do that. It's just the vagaries of the individual participants and things like that I'm not allowed to disclose at this time. And I people don't know anything about – we don't know anything about when we're actually going to start production. We just know we're moving very confidently along the path to that, but there are no dates yet. And the thing that everyone goes to immediately or they want to discuss – is the last thing that gets accomplished, which is the casting. And the casting
is the last
thing.
Yeah, everyone wants
to
know who's Lestat.
Exactly. And we love the suggestions and the proposals and the pictures that get posted on the Vampire Chronicles Facebook page. We do have a Facebook page that's dedicated to discussing readers and fans of the books discussing the series. That's the Vampire Chronicles on Facebook. It's a verified with a blue check mark. So
And that's also where we'll get the first reveals of secret things when you
I'm
can talk about it, right?
I'm pretty sure we do. If we have a reveal, if we're not making it there, we're fighting hard behind the scenes to have it made there. I think we were inspired by what Outlander did, where they did reveal the casting on the Facebook page, either for Diana Gabaldon or her show. I can't remember, but there was a Facebook reveal of the cast, and I definitely think we're exploring the possibility of doing something similar. So, but that will be the last thing that gets done because it all depends on availability.
Right.
Yeah,
in the end, everyone will be so surprised when Christopher Rice is Lestat.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Oh, you know, Lisa, you're flattering me. I'm way too old. I just turned 40 2 days ago. Lestat is 25 when he's made it
this
to a vampire.
This is Lestat the older years.
Yeah,
well,
that's the thing. Vampires don't get older, so.
I know, right? Yeah, damn it. Oh,
yeah.
Well.
Yeah.
Well, it's very exciting. I'm thrilled for you.
Thank you.
And as a huge Vampire Chronicles fan, I'm just thrilled that it's finally getting its due. Although I really did like the movie, I was very surprised at Tom Cruise's Lestat, but it was actually really good. So if you guys haven't seen that movie, didn't your mom write the screenplay for that one?
She did. She did. She wrote the screenplay for Interview with the Vampire.
Yeah, you should definitely see that one. It'll whet your taste buds for the TV show.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I know you are so busy with the TV and the books that you're not really doing many signings or you know, going to reader events, but you told me you have something coming up in September with J.R. Ward, so readers out there, get tickets.
It's the first unfortunately, I think it's sold out, but there might be a wait
list.
Oh, is
it?
J.R. Ward is launching an event together with 1001 Dark Nights called Readers on the River, which is in Louisville, Kentucky, which is where she lives. And it's the first ever event of this type that she's doing. She'll be the keynote speaker, but for her keynote speech, I am interviewing her, which is going to be a lot of fun. She's a good friend of mine. And
fun.
I'm looking forward to it, and it's a great excuse to dive deeper into the Black Dagger Brotherhood series, which I've been reading right along. And I am really looking forward to it, and there are going to be a lot of great authors there. Jennifer Armentrout, Lexi Blake. I'm going to just start rattling off my Dark Knights friends without realizing if any of them are confirmed. But there's a website, Readers on the River, and it's going to be – I think it's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be – I don't think it's going to be as huge. She's done very big fan events. I think this is going to, they're shooting for maybe a middle range, but if you're interested in going, definitely go to their website and see what the wait list situation is currently, because I think there are always people who drop out and can't make it and all that sort of stuff, and we want everyone who wants to go to have a shot.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. I can't believe we're
Absolutely.
Out of time, but this was great fun, and good luck with Bone Music. I can't wait to read it.
I hope you enjoy it, and I really appreciate you having me on. And I'll see you the next time I'm in San Diego. Any excuse to get to San Diego, I take, because I love the city so much.
Right? Yeah, come down and see me. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Bye, Lisa.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You for joining us on Book Lights. Be sure to connect with us at readersentertainment.com for articles, blogs, videos, and podcasts that matter to readers.